Learning more about money is one thing, putting it into action is totally another. Because why else would so many of us keep doing the things we know are holding us back? That's why today we're diving into three money psychology tricks that I personally used to change how I handle my money. Because knowing the tactics is useless if you're not able to actually put them into action. Here's the thing. Being good with money is not what people expect. It's not about having a big pile of money that you never touch and never use. It's about deciding on the life you want and then working backwards to decide what money changes you need to make in order to make that life happen. Then you have to know yourself so that you can put these changes into action in a way that actually works for you. I'm so lucky to speak to the amazing experts on this podcast, and sometimes the things they say keep me thinking for days or weeks later. So, three of the best tips, tricks, concentrated down into a special episode for you, everything from how you break bad habits that hold you back, to working better with your partner, to setting those goals that you want from life and then actually sticking with them. So welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. And we're starting with an underrated but really important one. A saying that has burrowed its way into my brain and refused to leave is you can't read the label from inside the bottle. Basically, no matter how good you are, you will never be able to objectively look at your own situation. You need outside eyes, whether it's friends, family, or a coach that you hire. So here's Akoya CEO Claire Barnes on how she overcame a $100,000 fear of failure, why a coach was key for that, and the tactics she uses now to keep that fear of failure at bay that the rest of us can steal.
The hustle is real, right? Every day is chaotic. You kind of forget that. You've got no space to tap into what you feel because you're just running on fumes. So I think for me, that going away, getting out of my daily work routine away from my beautiful children and really just setting aside that time to really actually think about what's going on for me was really, really valuable. And then one of the speakers at that event was Siri Limley. She's got a book called Finding a Way. I resonated so much with her that I did this coaching with her for 8 weeks and have done some other coaching with her since. And she just did this kind of small coaching group with me and I think six or seven other people. It was about understanding what you want. And then her whole philosophy is finding a way. So letting absolutely nothing get in the way of what you're going after. And so that's pretty powerful. And then she kind of really helped me define my purpose. So once I defined that, then anything I thought about doing, I'd sort of come back to those four things. Does it fit in with those four things? And if it fits in with those four things, then yes, I should do it. If it doesn't, maybe not.
So how did you change things on that in terms of thinking about the story you're telling yourself? And how that worked or didn't work for you, and then also finding your purpose and pushing towards that. How did that change from that coaching?
Like, it's all mindset. So my story had been that, you know, I needed to be really successful. One day when I had all the things I dreamed of, then I would feel good enough. Mm-hmm. So I kind of took that away and I'm actually already good enough. I've got everything I need within me right now to do everything I want to do. And there's nothing that I can't achieve. So it was kind of, you know, just completely changing that mindset. Yeah.
Yeah. And did that change at all when you had that realization? How did that change how you operate? And did it change sort of that purpose that you were driving towards?
Yeah. So it's really hard, right? Like any motivational speaker or someone giving advice says you've got to believe in yourself. But like, how do you believe in yourself when you don't really believe in yourself? Mm-hmm. Like, how? You can't just, okay, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and believe in myself. Like, how? So you kind of got to stack your proof. So go back and find things that you've done well at before and stack the proof that you are capable. So find those things that you did well at. Find those things where you felt really good in your family and your work and sports events or whatever, and stack that proof that you actually can. And so every time that sort of that negativity creeps in, just go back and stack that proof. And also, like, Suri's really open and gutsy about what it takes to be a world champion triathlete and the actual physical pain she went through in that training. And so now I actually kind of enjoy the pain of, like, she kind of, it's like when things go wrong or like when things don't quite go as planned, it's like, this is what I asked for. Rather than going, oh, everything's going wrong, it's like, no, this is exactly what I asked for. This is like the next thing that I'll solve, and I'll make a decision, and then I'll make another decision, and it'll get me that next step towards where I want to go. And it's just that mindset. It's a complete mindset shift of everything that happens is what I asked for.
That's tapping into something I've been thinking about a lot just in the last couple of weeks, where someone said to me, anytime you want to get stronger, you have to feel weak to do it. And the most obvious example is hitting the gym. You know, you're trying to lift weights, you're trying to build your muscles stronger. You're going to feel weak lifting those weights, but that's part of the process. But it actually applies to everything. That metaphor works in all sorts of ways. So is that sort of the framing you're taking on when you hit these roadblocks, when you hit these hard parts, you're like, the other side of this is going to be the good bit, and I have to have this to get to that?
Yeah, 100%. And the easiest way is what you just described in the gym, or like for me, it's hiking up a mountain or running. And it's like when it gets really hard and you kind of want to give up and you want to stop, you're like, yes, this is the good bit. Yeah. This is a bit that is going to make me better, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're like, it's easy.
Yeah.
And you just keep going.
I think there's a reason. You see, not every business leader, not every sort of entrepreneurial type, but a lot of them are also quite health nuts and quite into that stuff. And I think there is that sort of, A, it's nice to get out of your head and do something purely physical. It can be a bit of a breather. But it also, it is this metaphor for so many other areas of life where you learn to push yourself and push through pain, and that getting to the other side of it is good stuff. You said earlier as well about you kind of enjoy feeling that fear now because you can harness it. It can be useful. Now, I'm an anxiety girly myself, and it's something that I have had to learn. I don't think that's ever going away. I think that's always going to be part of me and my makeup. And actually stopping fighting it has been so helpful. Now I try to say, you know, how can I use this in a way that is useful to me? You know, anxiety has helped me build things, push myself harder, try to be the best, try to look for ways that something could fall apart and deal with it ahead of time and put out the best version that I can. I just have to make sure that I'm harnessing it in a useful way and not a paralyzing way, because, you know, it can paralyze you, but can also drive you. Is that been what it's been like for you with this fear of failure, where you've learned how to harness that? What does that look like when you're feeling it and harnessing it?
I think I just don't really believe in letting it stop me anymore. Like, I think I acknowledge that it stopped me, and I don't, and I'm kind of making a conscious choice not to let it stop me anymore. And it doesn't mean, like, leaning into the hard stuff, it doesn't mean that it's not hard. It's like, I'd said to my mum when I got back from Tony Robbins, I'd said to her, you know, mum, I realize I've got this crippling fear of failure, like crippling. I can't move past it, or I haven't been able to move past it. And she was shocked. And she looked at me like, you've got that. She was like, blown away. Because from the outside, I guess I hadn't talked about it, and I come across as quite confident. But just because you carry the load well doesn't mean it isn't heavy, you know? It's okay to still find things hard. Like, things are hard. Like, the juggle is hard. Like, now I have my roller to coil, which I'm fastidious about not dropping the ball there. Got Bowie. I've got two kids. I sit on the board of one of my kids' schools. I've got and sit on another board. We've got another startup. Like, life is nuts. You know, it's hard. And like, every night when we go to bed, I say to my husband, I swear, I'm quite a swearer, often late at night. And I swear, and then I say, it's so late again. I'm going to bed so late because I just can't get everything done in the day. And I know that my sleep is so important. And, you know, but I'm frustrated with myself that I haven't gone to bed earlier. But like, it's hard. Like, the season that we're in is stay up late, get the shit done, worry about tomorrow.
Okay. So once you've done the inside work, it's time to set those external goals and start moving. Here's where values-based spending comes into play, where you decide on what matters to you, your life, and how your money tactics should change based on that. It's not only useful for you, but if you're trying to work alongside a partner, this can be the tactic that finally helps you work with each other instead of against each other. So financial advisor James Blair is ready to tell us what actually works to keep himself and his clients on track. You mentioned earlier, and you've just sort of hinted at it again, about telling clients to spend more. I mean, A, look at your budget and actually be realistic. Let's build a budget that is not just who you want to be, but who you actually are, which I think is one thing. I still struggle with that when I'm looking at my numbers, and let's actually be realistic here. But also this idea of spend more if it's something that you actually want. What are the guardrails on that? Because of course there are limits to this idea of values-based spending, right? There's a world where you can use it to justify anything. You say, I want a Ferrari. It'll make me happy. Give it to me.
Well, a Ferrari would make you happy, right?
Yeah, for at least a week. It would be quite fun, right. I'm sure. How do you genuinely assess what is truly going to bring value to my life? What is actually a good purchase to make here?
So it's looking at your goals in totality. So the idea is what do you want to achieve, not just in the short term, but the other goals. Mm. So what we find is that most people's goals tend to fall in the same kind of areas. So what are the short term things that are important to me in terms of my life right now? Where do I want to live? So that might be I'm planning to upgrade my home. I want to renovate. I'm going to downsize. I want to rent long term, whatever it might be. When do I want to be financially free? So financially free, over my time as a financial advisor, at the start, retirement was a word that was used a lot and people still retire at 65. Now people don't really want to retire because we're all living longer. People want options. They don't want to be tied to the situation. And then the other category is, you know, around the kids. So what do we want to be able to do for the kids in the future if we've got kids? So some people want to be able to help with first cars, schooling, university, first homes, whatever it might be. And within all of those goals, you write them down. You go, when do you want them to happen? How much will it cost? And then you kind of go, from our perspective, like with a financial advisor, start to project all these things out and go, can we do them all? A lot of the time, the answer is yes, depending on the person's situation. But let's say the answer is no, that you can't do everything. Then financial planning is like essentially like a big game of what would you rather? Would you rather spend more money? Like, do you want to extend the retirement age and maintain your lifestyle? Do you actually not like the kids that much and you want to scrap them? Do you want to spend a little bit less money on travel so you can retire earlier? Is the renovation on the home actually that important? And then you have to prioritize all of these different goals. That's actually how, opposed to just buying Ferraris, you kind of have to look at it in totality and go, can I achieve all of my goals? Now, in a scenario where somebody can achieve all of their goals, I'm a big fan. Have you heard of the book and the concept Die with Zero?
Yes, I have. But explain it for us again, because some people won't have. And it's a great one. I do recommend for those who like a little read or even an audiobook. I'm pretty sure it's on audiobook. Yep. It's a great one. But give us the potted history of it.
Die with Zero, pretty much the idea is that money is like energy. And essentially across your life, all of your money should be allocated and be spent. Like, you shouldn't be having unallocated money. So for example, in finance, when we're doing financial projections, within like a room for error, you should be like by the time you hit 1995, all of your money should be gone. If you're dying with lots of money left over, it's missed opportunities. And those missed opportunities can be different for everybody. Maybe we could have lived in that nicer house, or we could have gone on more holidays, or I could have retired earlier from the job that I didn't like. Or instead of letting my kids get to 70 before they received an inheritance, I could give them a warm inheritance or help them with their home. Or there's a charity I'm really passionate about that I could have given some money. And from a selfish perspective, I get to see some enjoyment from that as well. So the idea is that we shouldn't be like Scrooge McDuck and be sitting on this big pile of gold. We should be allocating all of our money to different purposes, both now and in the future, and a life well lived. Like I tell my clients, a good financial advisor should make sure you die with less money. And they go like, that's a really weird concept. But money, once again, money is just a tool to enjoy now or later. If you're not going to enjoy it at all, what was the point in earning it?
Exactly. I feel like that there's this real misconception, and it's so deeply culturally rooted that I think it's always going to stick around, but I'm always going to push back against it too. That the idea of being good with money means you have a big pile of it and you don't touch it and you live this life of deprivation. And that is just the wrong way to approach it. Money is a tool. It's a tool for building the life you want. It's a tool for helping people around you. It's a tool for building the future you want. And if you sit down and get strategic with it, I would really hope you can, as you say, maybe you can't do everything. Maybe you can. Awesome. But you can at least look at it and say, what is the big thing I want and how do I use the money to achieve that? When you're sitting down with people and you're setting these goals and sort of trying to figure out what they actually want from life, I mean, how often should you do that? Is that sort of like you sit down once you do it, or should we be doing this every year or whatever? And also, do people ever struggle to actually articulate what they really want? Because I'm sure they must.
Oh, yeah. And if they're in a relationship, there is a step before that where you're like pretty much I'm a low-key like marriage counselor where like, I mean, we know that like 50% of people get divorced, and a big reason for divorces around money. Like I'll give you examples of really bad goals. So mm-hmm. A goal is not we should spend less money. A goal is not I want to buy an investment property. A goal is not I want to have $1 million in shares. They are bad goals, because what is my motivation to spend less money or buy a property? Nobody wants these things. They want what they think doing these things will give them in the future. So you better to do that. If you're in a relationship, what you need to do opposed to telling your spouse to spend less money, which is very common in relationships because 90% of couples, like we're with different money personalities. Like how often do you talk to someone and one's a spender and one's a saver?
Every time.
And it creates like heaps of conflict. You get home on like a Thursday night, you're like, I don't want to like get into like a big fight about this. The thing that you need to do is go, what is the life we're trying to build? So what are the things that are important to us as a household? And a lot of the time I find these conversations haven't been happening because they're worried about how they're going to go. There might be like a degree of conflict. There's been conflict around it in the past. And then once you kind of go, we've got that framework around like the house and, you know, do you feel like you're missing out right now? When do you want to retire? What do you want to do for the kids? And then there's like a bit of like compromise and negotiation between the two. But then once you've got those locked down, then you go, what behaviors, what actions do we need to take to be able to achieve those objectives? Because a plan, projections does not make anybody rich. Goals don't make anybody rich. It's the habits and the actions behind it and setting good structure that will get us to those. In terms of like how often you should review the plan, the thing I would say is like you think you're going to start here and get to here, and it's just going to be this nice linear line. But as Mike Tyson says, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. You know, we will have house prices will drop. We will be made redundant. People will get sick. We'll see divorces. We'll have an issue with our property or whatever it might be. A plan should be reviewed at least once a year because your life's going to change. The plan really shouldn't change. Like we've got a very straightforward framework for growing wealth. It's adjusting the plan to what's happening in the person's life. The plan only needs to change because of the person. The strategy, and I'm sure you talk about this a lot, people tinker with their finances way too much. It's what happens in people's lives where the plan needs to change.
Here's where we hit the home stretch, because even once you know what you want and why, your brain incredibly likely to sabotage you. That's because some of our wiring as humans just trips us up on this money stuff. psychologist, and multiple times best-selling author Dr. Brad Klontz has read all the research and is ready to tell us how our brains work and how we can be ready for that in order to sidestep the common pitfalls that can keep us stuck.
What do you think people get wrong about money and how they think about it?
Oh, so many things. The biggest problem we have in America is that people spend more than they make and they don't save for the future. Those are the two biggest problems. And I've yet to meet someone who doesn't know better. So, I mean, I'm a fan of financial literacy. I think it's great, but I don't think that's the core problem. People already know what they should be doing. They're not doing it. And that is what has been really interesting to me as a psychologist. Why are people not doing what they already know they should be doing?
Well, that's the thing, right, isn't it? I mean, there's a stat that you see thrown around. I have no idea if it's based on fact, but it's one of those stats that feels true, where they say it's 20% the numbers of money, and it's actually 80% the mindset. Exactly what you've just identified there. Oftentimes we know what we should be doing, but we just don't. What are some of the things that get in the way? What stops us from doing what we know would help us out in the future?
Well, I think it's a couple things. The first one is just how we're wired as human beings. We are just not wired to do the right thing when it comes to money. Money is a relatively new concept. To do well around money, you have to have a really clear vision of the future. You have to delay gratification. You have to focus on saving and investing instead of consuming. 99% of our time on this planet, we have been in small hunter-gatherer tribes, 100 to 150 people, and we're wired to consume as much as possible for many reasons. First, food would spoil. There wasn't enough to go around. When it comes to saving, too, if you kept too much for yourself, the rest of the tribe would look poorly upon you. Maybe you'd get exiled and die in the wilderness. And so I can actually trace a lot of our problems with money to this tribal ancient brain we have. So we're just wired to do it all wrong. So that's the first part. And then the second part is your specific psychology around money. And so this has been much of what I've researched over the years is the experiences you've had around money growing up in your culture. What were you taught about money based on your gender, your religion, your socioeconomic status growing up, your country, like all these messages that come to us in these experiences, these lead to your money scripts. So these are your beliefs around money. And that's what I've spent a lot of time researching over the last 20 years is your individual beliefs around money and how they predict your income, your net worth, your credit card behaviors, and all of that. So we're all wired to do it wrong. And then specifically, we have experiences based on our upbringing, based on our generational patterns. Like some of these things get passed down through the generations to us. We're not even aware of them. But that's what predicts our success and or failure around money.
So if we have all of this wiring that goes quite deep, you know, you've got, like you say, the caveman wiring that is really in there as part of our evolutionary basis as people. And then we've got all of these layers on top of it from how we've gone through life, as you say, the culture we're in. How much can we change that and take control of it when some of this goes so deep?
Well, I'm a strong proponent of believing that we can control everything. And actually, I think that's the best mindset to have.
You mentioned the hedonic treadmill before, and that is it's a theory that I'm a big fan of. It clarified a lot of things for me. We've actually not talked about it on this podcast before. So I would love for you to give us a quick run through of what is the hedonic treadmill? What is that theory? And how should it change how we look at our money, do you think?
Yeah, in essence, it is the concept that you're never actually going to be satisfied by external things. So, and real specifically with money too, it's like when you ask people who make $50,000 a year, what would it take to be happy? They say 100. And when you ask people who make 100, they say like 200 and blah, 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 just continues to go. And it's a really important concept to understand because otherwise you're going to become a victim to it. Especially if you're more materialistic. So once I get this next thing, this next shiny object, then I'm going to be happy. So it's like when then. So when this happens, then I'm going to have this emotional experience that I want to have. And it's just really important to understand that this is how you're wired as a human being. And you're going to be tempted to do it, especially when you see things that are shiny and that other people might have. And if you don't recognize that that's the way you're wired, you're going to probably be in a financial struggle your entire life. because you're always going to be spending your money in ways that you think are going to make you happier, but don't.
Yeah, basically we normalize, right? Whatever we've got, you know, at some point you might, let's just take a really silly example for my fellow girlies, you know, you might always do your nails yourself and then you get a pay rise and you can start getting your nails done professionally. And for a while, that's going to be really exciting. You're going to be like, yay, I always have pretty hands. 6 months to a year down the track, that's just going to be your normal. That's just going to be something that you always have. And you're not even going to find it exciting and fun and nice anymore. You're going to be wanting to have a new outfit every month instead. And that's going to be the thing that's holding you back. But you still want the nails because that's now your normal. And it's really hard, right? Isn't it? It's like what you said before about this automatic dissatisfaction has pushed humanity forward for so long, but it can absolutely sabotage our money if we don't understand that that's how we're wired, right?
I think so. And I, for me, it's being conscious of it. So I'm sitting here talking about it. You know, I'm just as vulnerable to this mindset as anyone else. Mm. It happens to me all the time. I'm just aware of it and I kind of chuckle, you know, and and I set goals for myself because I know that that's what I want because it motivates me and it excites me. But I also know through experience and, you know, through the it's almost the curse of achieving goals too is sort of an ironic thing. And I've worked with a lot of entertainers and people who've entered, you know, big sports contracts or whatever. They sold their business for $25 million and they finally achieved it. And then 6 months later, they're depressed. And from all external points of view, it's like, are you crazy? You have it all. You have it all. And it's like, well, that's human nature. We are very attuned to what everyone else is doing. This is part of that tribal brain. Like the people who didn't care what people thought about them, they all died. You know, they didn't pass on their genes. Like they were kicked out of the tribe. I mean, are you kidding me? You don't care what we all think about you? And so it's like, it's really trite advice to say, oh, you shouldn't care about what people think. Now, what I'm trying to do though, is really, really define who this self-made rich crowd is, who this tribe is, so that you understand how they act around money. Because I want you to be, you know, if you want to join that tribe, you need to think about how they look at things and how they would look at you. And just understanding the truth around it. And you're seeing some outliers out there who are lavish spenders and all this and that. But even like, and I work with very wealthy individuals. I work with some, and it's so interesting because the founders, you know, the ones who started out with nothing and have hundreds of millions now, they're the ones who are really concerned about spending and where the money's going. Mm-hmm. And then the next generation less concerned. So a lot of times you'll see a little bit more flash coming from them. But the bottom line is if you are really into it for the flashy stuff, you're never going to become rich because as soon as you get money, you're going to go spend it. I mean, if as I say it out loud, it sounds so obvious, you know, that like if you're blowing your money on crap, you're not going to have money anymore. But social media is so loud with it. And, you know, we get on social media and we feel deprived. In psychology, we call it relative deprivation. It's like we don't judge our well-being based on objective numbers. It's strictly in comparison to other people. So just understanding that this is your inherent psychological vulnerability, you can have millions in the bank, but if you're comparing yourself to people who have hundreds of millions, you're going to feel deprived. You know, if you have two goats in the village and everyone else has one goat, you're going to feel twice as wealthy. I mean, it's all emotional, it's all psychological, and it all goes back to that tribe. So there is no number that's going to make you feel rich. I was recently talking to somebody who grew up poor, became a multimillionaire, went to a boat show, and he's looking at boats that are $3 million, and he's looking around, he's like, these people have hundreds of millions. So he goes to another place, feels utterly deprived and broke. I mean, so that is the game. That is how we're wired. And so just being aware of that too, because what people do is they have a vision of how people spend their money and then they go, you know, they spend every last dime or leverage themselves to get into this wealthy way of being, not realizing that that mindset is the poor mindset.
Just a note before you go, this podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.